So, Hare Krishna, this is the second of our series of talks on Grihastha issues. Shyamasundara Prabhu and his wife won't be participating because he feels that the topics are so great and he has so much to say, he'd rather at some other point in time just speak himself. And also, of course, he has a unique perspective as an astrologer. Nartak Gauranga Prabhu is trying to come in on this, but we're waiting. He's having technical problems. Okay. So the subject that we're discussing is the very concept of marriage, both within Krishna conscious life, and or among devotees and among non-devotees. And we can add some nuance to that also. The concept of married life among Indians or followers of the Vedic culture and others, because there is a difference in attitude, generally speaking, in marriage in India to the Western countries. So it's a big topic. Would any of you like to lead it away? Tapan Mishra, you'd like to say something?
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. So in preparation for this conversation, we wanted to prepare a few things. And if, with your permission, I wanted to just read the conventional, because you said to contrast our understanding of Vedic marriage with conventional marriage. I wanted to read something which I found in terms of a definition of marriage to begin with. And marriage as is defined in the Encyclopedia Britannica states the following. It says it's a legally and socially sanctioned union, usually between a man and a woman, that is regulated by laws, rules, customs, beliefs, and attitudes that prescribe the rights and duties of the partners and accord status to their offspring, if any. The universality of marriage within different societies and cultures is attributed to the many basic social and personal functions for which it provides structure, such as sexual gratification and regulation, division of labor between the sexes, economic production and consumption, and satisfaction of personal needs for affection, status, and companionship. Perhaps its strongest function concerns procreation, the care of children, and their education and socialization, and regulation of lines of descent. Through the ages, marriages have taken a great number of forms. It was heartening to read this definition, in the sense that it alluded to some of the very important points that Srila Prabhupada mentions and emphasizes, that householder life is for procreation of God-conscious children, their training, and so on and so forth. We feel very fortunate to the guidance given by Srila Prabhupada in his books and by his very, very sincere followers such as yourself, who also give us a broad outline of how to conduct ourselves. We felt, Guru Maharaj, that marriage and entrance into marriage is also preparation, something that was touched upon last time. And I'll request Indira Sakhi Devi to share some of the thoughts that we feel need to be considered when we try to contrast marriage from the perspective of Vedic marriage and Krishna conscious marriage versus secular marriages. So I'll request her to share also those criteria or parameters that we felt should be considered. You have to be loud.
Okay. So we looked at few points that were very much in contrast between the Vedic understanding and how it is, how marriage is practiced or conducted these days in modern life. So the first thing which was very clear is that the goal is different. Of course, this colors the entire lifestyle of a person, what their goal is. So marriage is an essential part of one's life in most cases. Therefore, the goal also makes a difference as to how people enter into marriage, conduct themselves, and how they go about their life, married life. So the goal in Vedic culture or Vaishnava culture is that everything, every aspect of our life is managed in such a way that there is spiritual advancement. So that is also the goal of entering into and remaining in Grihastha Ashram. But in modern life, the goal is enjoyment, essentially. So that's sense gratification, which means that the aim is that how I can live comfortably and what arrangements I can make. So when people are looking at whether they should get married and how they should remain within their marriage, it's all the underlying principle is to remain happy, and the, which is not bad in itself, but the concept of happiness is closely tied to being satisfied materially and enjoying their senses. So that's a very different goal in itself, that if you want to make spiritual progress or you just want to satisfy your senses. So that makes a difference in a lot of aspects of marriage, such as the choice of spouse, how the husband and wife conduct themselves, and their day-to-day activities within marriage. So that was one aspect which we felt is glaringly different between Vedic marriage and conventional modern marriages.
Also, we felt that in terms of the first step of entering into marriage, conventional, or I would say Vedic marriages and Vaishnava marriage was more or less arranged. They were mostly arranged. In the contrast, when we look at secular marriages now, they're mostly not arranged. Some of them are purely accidents. And we felt that people enter into marriage mostly ad hoc. Some of them enter into it just because they want to have a sexual relationship and they feel that this will sort of give them an opportunity to create an arrangement where that can be fulfilled, which according to definition is an important thing, but it becomes, in a lot of cases, it becomes a primary criteria. The other thing that these days people enter into marriages, they're having living relationships, and then suddenly most often the ladies or the women in the relationship feel they feel that the time clock is running away, so they want to tie a knot. So the man sort of then just enters into it for that sake. Some enter into it in societies such as India, at least it used to be, but it's fast changing. They enter into marriage because there's a social convention that any union between man and wife, it should be under marriage. And besides that, they still see the institution of marriage around them and they feel it's just the right thing to do. Having said that, a lot of them just do it in a very ad hoc, automatic way. Not much thought goes into it. So when I talk to my friends who studied with me, etc., it was just one of the other things that they do. You know, people take jobs and they get married and that's it. And then they figure it out later on. So goal of marriage was one. The second that we like to talk about is the roles. So from this goal comes the notion of roles. How are roles to be balanced? Or if there's a notion of roles between Vedic marriage versus secular marriages. So we'll take just a minute to talk about that.
Yeah, so the Vedic understanding takes into consideration the inherent nature of men and women, and accordingly the roles are prescribed within marriage. But we see increasingly how this has changed. The concept is of equality, that there's no specific role. It's that whatever works for you should be all right. But it has also caused a lot of confusion, because people are experimenting with it. And for the past many decades, that has been going on. And it's not been very successful. It has actually put more stress on both parties, because the women are not satisfied with being at home. They have stepped out. They've started taking jobs without really figuring the whole thing out. The men are also, they cannot just be the breadwinner. They're also expected to help out at home. So it's very confusing right now, the way things are. It's not very, it's not clear, although so many, there are books written on it, there are so many people talking about it, they appear to present it that this is the much better version, but the practical reality is that it has put more stress on either side and created misunderstandings. So that was another aspect, that although it, the Vedic version is clear, and it's not just that it's been in India, it's been universally accepted earlier.
And how clear it is the third point we want to talk about, guidelines. So it's not left for people to figure it out. The family structure that used to be traditionally the Vedic institution, or the Vedic institution of marriage, has clear guidelines as to how one must conduct itself. So these are time-tested guidelines on what age one should get married in, how one should have children early. And time-tested wisdom has shown that those who actually conduct according to this formula just have a good physical, mental, and a good spiritual well-being also, if they conduct according to the guidelines that are offered. The institution of marriage in the case of Vedic system and Vaishnava system actually is a great contributor to the society, because amongst all the other ashrams, it's the householders who sustain or contribute to the economic productivity of the rest of the ashram. So in contrast, where everybody's on their own, just wanting to enjoy and wondering what contribution does marriage really have, which is a fact. You know, I would also ask the same question in conventional marriages: what contribution or secular marriage is really making to the society? In contrast to that, the Vedic marriage is a cornerstone to also hold the ashram system together. Last but not the least, it is one step in the whole life of the couple. The institution, if practiced according to the guidelines, prepares them, sets them up. It helps them fulfill the goal by following the roles with a proper guideline, sets them up and makes them ready for the next blissful step, which is the Vanaprastha ashram. If there is conflict in Vedic system, there is a provision to solve it. You know, you go to the elders, to the more experienced, etc. So in contrast, we see in secular marriages right now, without that support system, it's broken. It's broken, and it brings with it a lot of issues. So those were some of the points we wanted to explore in today's discussion. And I'll be grateful if Guru Maharaj, yourself, and especially my other god brothers who are present, and householders, could also share their perspectives on similar topics.
Okay. The Britannica definition, it spoke of religion, marriage as in practically a permanent institution within human society, but it didn't mention religion. It traditionally, all over the world, marriage has been a religious function. It's not necessary just in, without religion, traditionally, marriage, why don't you just live together? Why do you have to have a religious bond? Why is it performed in a church? I don't know exactly how the Muslims do it, but they have some ceremony, Buddhists, Hindus, everyone. There's an understanding of God or higher power and making a commitment to God. And in the light of society and humans working together with a higher goal, that's always been there. Another thing they mentioned, usually between men and women, but that's only very recently. They're talking about the whole span of human civilization, and it's always been between man and woman. And now they say usually between man and woman, which is, if you take it in the history of time, what's called man-to-man or woman-to-woman marriage is going to be less than 0.00001%. But you see, this kind of thing, the Encyclopaedia Britannica definition, is a reflection of the kind of propaganda that comes out from supposedly educated and enlightened people who are undermining the whole society by undermining marriage, the roles of men and women, or even the definition of what it means to be a man or a woman. It's demoniac in a single term. Much of what they say may be correct, and they're supposed to be writing with academic neutrality, but it's not. Be very careful of this so-called education that we get in the universities. It's very insidious. Do you know what that means, insidious? It means of evil intent, which may not be very openly and easily recognized. Okay, Gopal, I'm just asking in the order that I can see you on the screen. So, Gopal Acharya, please add your thoughts to this. Vedic and secular or conventional. Well, really, there's no such thing as secular marriage. That's a recent invention, but we can say conventional marriage. Non-Krishna conscious marriage.
Well, the basic difference is that the whole underlying principle of marriage is completely different. Marriage within Krishna consciousness is just a situation which should be supportive of the higher goal, which is becoming Krishna conscious and becoming detached also from that institution of marriage or anything else within this material world. Whereas it seems that within the non-devotional circles, marriage seems to be, on one hand, it seems to be the goal in itself. People get married because they think that this is what's going to give them happiness. On the other hand, without understanding the nature of the material reality of the material world, when faced with misery that is there to come for sure, certainly, we're going to suffer in this material world, then, and because then that goal is not being served by that institution of marriage, so people basically can't cope with it. They don't have any ideas or any tools or any understanding of the situation, so that's why there's divorce, and that's why they can't stay, because the goal is not being achieved, so they have to get out of this. So yeah, there's, on one hand, it seems that marriage within the non-devotional circles, it seems to be like one of the important goals in life. On the other hand, it's completely undefined, really. We don't know what is the purpose, what is the goal, how to run it, how to manage, how to deal with difficulties, and especially in the modern society, the way it is being organized these days, it is more and more difficult. There's no religion anymore present, or its presence is very vague and scant. So yeah, I mean, Krishna conscious marriage and the whole idea is very clear and makes it very easy, actually. Even when we have to deal with difficulties, which do occur, of course, by having a clearly defined goal and understanding of what is this meant for makes it much easier to go through all those challenges in life. And we also understand that this is not the goal in itself. Married life is not the goal, it's not the end, it's just one period of life through which we have to go with the idea of dealing with certain attachments or difficulties that we may all, we may have, and that particular ashram may be suitable for the person who enters it, just to cope with those whatever desires, attachments, and so on. But finally, the goal is to come out of that situation and to become detached from the material life and to enter then other stages of life. So it's very different concept, it's very different understanding, and it is, and I can't basically imagine living married life without Krishna consciousness. It must be very difficult and disappointing. Stop here.
One thing, Gopal, we're having in the background from your sound, the sounds of married life, the kids playing and making a racket in the background. So maybe you could do something about that before you next speak. Thank you for your thoughts. That's not your kids, I think, because your son is older than that makes that kind of noise when he's playing, I hope. And your daughter, at least when she's outside the home, she's very quiet. So maybe that's someone else's kids. Anyway, let's go on to America. Nityagaura Prabhu and Mataji, please. Give your...
Yes, Guru Maharaj.
From the homeland of all confusion, America, it generates all strange ideas about genders and life in general. It's a madhouse. But you're not American. You're American-bodied devotees of Krishna. How I escaped American life while living in America. Okay, please tell us.
Guru Maharaj, I don't know, at least in my head right now, how much I can add to what the other devotees were saying. I guess I just see the practical effect of marriage not being understood and instituted in this country. I could say something about that, but I don't know what else I could add into the theory of what the other devotees were saying.
The practical effect is disaster, chaos at an individual and societal level. And guess who suffers the most? Is it the men or the women? It's the children. A few years ago, somewhere in California, I think it was San Diego, a young man who was taken to Krishna consciousness introduced himself to me and said, I was raised by my mother. I never knew my father. My mother was a prostitute and a drug addict or something. No, lesbian and I don't know. Just, he said it as if it was the most normal thing in the world. It was bizarre.
Yes, Guru.
Okay, Mataji, please. Any thoughts?
I'd like to speak from what I've heard from a quite extensive series of lectures from His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Purna Maharaj called Men-Women Interaction. And therein, he describes the difference between a Vedic marriage and non-Vedic marriage. And the key word that he stressed upon was a sense of duty. and that within the Vedic marriage, there's a strong sense of duty, and that that actually is what allows for both husband and wife to feel stable within the marriage. And it, we've already brought up this point about roles, and I just want to share one example he gave of the contrast. Maharaj explained that when there's a strong sense of duty within the household, even if there's conflict, still both husband and wife are engaging in their prescribed duties. And so, for example, if the wife is upset because of some happening, still she will perform her duty and prepare dinner so that when her husband returns home, he has a meal to eat. And even though she is upset, still she is conducting her duty properly. And that in comparison with a non-Vedic or Vaishnav marriage, there's no sense of duty and responsibility in that, to that degree. Even I don't know how much, to what degree it is there. And so you will have instances where a wife may be upset, and so she refuses to cook because she's angry at her husband. Or even if it's not because of some conflict, if she just doesn't feel like it, then her husband and her children are going without a freshly cooked meal. And in this American culture, I've seen advertisements for decorations within the home, particularly, you know, like posters for your kitchen that say that the menu for every day of the week. And basically all of it says, you know, you do it yourself, because the woman is just too busy, or she just doesn't feel like it, so it shouldn't be expected. And because of this, there is so much of a sense of instability and concern, because you don't actually know who's going to do what, who's taking care of you, what is to be expected. And so it keeps everyone in anxiety. So that was one point I wanted to bring up. And along with the sense of duty, I wanted to bring up the aspect of having children, particularly amongst devotees, practicing devotees. Husband and wife are having children out of a sense of duty, whereas everyone else, they don't necessarily want to be bothered with having children, because again, it's not about being married to be responsible citizens in the world, but just to enjoy one way or another. It was just something I wanted to add.
Mm. Then Natakaranga Prabhu?
As I was thinking on this topic of Vedic marriage and modern marriages, difference between them, I just remembered the Sri Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami comparing Kama and Prema in Chaitanya Charitamrita. There are two extremes. Vedic marriage is centered around duty-centered, seva-centered, but modern marriages are lust-centered. It's like the whole idea is sense gratification. The whole purpose of marriage is sense gratification. But in modern marriages, in Vedic marriages, the whole purpose is dharma-centered. As Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur also says that out of dharma, I took up grihastha ashram. So that was the whole point in Vedic civilization. What is my kartavya? What is my duty? People live for their duty, and thereby they do all the activities. So that is the whole difference in all the aspects of modern life and Vedic life. Especially in marriages, it becomes very clear. So that is one difference, that modern marriages are sense gratification, lust-centered, and Vedic marriages are dharma-centered, kartavya-centered. Second difference, what I could imagine is, in Vedic marriages, the whole idea is cooperation. Cooperation, helping each other to advance in Krishna consciousness, to sacrifice for each other. For example, we see the example of Sita Mata. She was raised in kingly environment, but she went to forest along with her husband to serve him. And she could not digest that how my husband will go to forest and how I can live in the palace. So the whole idea, whole theme of people living in the Vedic civilization is their whole attitude is service-based. Whereas in modern marriages, it's like exploitation. Till the time my partner is giving me happiness, I am with him or her. And when the happiness goes, then better to say goodbye. Because the whole idea of life is sense gratification. Their whole aim of life is sense gratification. That is why the marriage, till the time it gives happiness to our senses, it's okay to live. After that, no need to live together. So I think the basic difference of thoughts, people's understanding has degraded to such a level which Shastras teach us not to go to that level. And the results of Vedic marriage and modern marriages, we can see that modern marriages ends in divorce, and in Vedic marriages, the wife used to live with the husband and wanted to leave with the husband, wanted to leave before the husband goes. And at least latest, if the husband dies, she doesn't want to live anymore. She wants to leave with the husband. So the whole idea, there's a total difference between modern and Vedic marriages. So as Srila Prabhupada in his books and various places, he emphasizes dharma, he emphasizes varnashram dharma, he emphasizes husband's duties of husband, duties of wives. I think that is the only solution to preach to the world Srila Prabhupada books, in which he gives the understanding, proper understanding of varnashram dharma, istri dharma, and what are the duties of husband. So I think that is the whole solution to change the system which is presently prevailing. That's all.
Then your dharma patni, will she speak now?
Guru Maharaj, as Vaishnavi Mataji said and Prabhuji said, that the dharma was the center in the Vedic culture, and the whole Vedic culture was based on the training aspect. The boys were also trained, the girls were also trained from their childhood about their duties, about their roles, and there were defined roles of men and women. So in the house there was no confusion, no intermixing of their roles. Like in modern marriages, both husband and wife, they are working outside, they are working on the same level. So they are expecting that one should do the other party's role, why I should do, there is intermingling of their roles. So conflict is more. So the roles should be defined, and there was no option of divorce in the Vedic marriages. That was also a very important point. Even many marriages we have seen that husband and wife are not compatible with each other, but in their mind there was no option of divorce. Though they carry on, they adjust. But like in your lecture you said, even Hiranyakashipu did not give divorce to his wife. And even the wife of Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, they did not leave their husband. So this option of divorce was not there. That was very important. And the center is dharma, the duty. And in the modern marriages, we are more centered on the rights. Rights, women right, human right, children right, husband right. So right is more important than duty. So we are expecting from the other party, he should do that, she should do that. But what we should do, we are not thinking on that. So that was there in the Vedic.
Regarding marriage, I can think of two statements that Srila Prabhupada often quoted from Shastra. One is from Manu, which is not what we would say overtly a Vaishnava text. I mean, it is, but it's more about the organization of society. So Srila Prabhupada was sometimes quoted from Manu, Putrarte Kriyate Bharya. Putra Pinda Prayojanam, that one gets married or accepts a wife for the purpose of having a son. And then the next line says, Putra Pinda Prayojanam, the son is required for offering pinda, which is part of the Shraddha ceremony, and that also helps the previous departed members of the family. And we see the Mahabharata and elsewhere, the Balakilyas, the very small sages, 60,000 of them performing tapasya because they didn't marry. They had to fulfill that duty. Of course, we also know in Krishna consciousness that Devarshi Putrapta, we don't have debts. If we're fully surrendered to Mukunda. So that's another consideration. But the point is there that one marries to have children, and especially a son. And another point about having a son is that the son, these are all practical considerations. The son has to look after the parents in old age, not the daughter. If there is a dot, it's the son's duty. And Manu also speaks about Dharmaputra, the first one, that to fulfill one's dharmic duty, one has a son. And then extra sons, they're called Kamaputras, which could be interpreted to mean they're just produced out of desire, but it can be also one desires to have more children. It's not necessarily a grossly lusty thing, but one desires to have more children. And generally, in the age before industrialization, mass urbanization, artificial contraception, having children, having more children was an economic boost, whereas nowadays having even one child is often seen as an economic burden. So that's one thing, Putrarte Kriyate Bharya. And then, of course, the famous Guru na swasyad, swajano na sasyad, pita na sasyad, janani na sasyad, daivang na tatsyan na patis na chasyad, na mochiyad ya samupetu mrityum. One should not become a guru, a relative, a father, a mother, an object of worship, or a father unless he can deliver his dependents from birth and death. So the Srila Prabhupada would often emphasize this, that the duty of the parents. Now, the duty of the parents within many cultures of the world, as here in India, it's quite strong still. The duty of the parents to provide food, clothing, shelter, that's the basics. And then among the burgeoning middle class, education also. But the idea that we're supposed to train the children so that they don't take birth again, the responsibility. One should not become a parent unless one can fulfill this duty. Srila Prabhupada often quoted this verse, as far as I see, he quoted this mostly in relationship to the role of parenthood. So the great responsibility to deliver the children from birth and death. And you can do that as best as you can. You have your duty to try, and later if they decide it otherwise, there's not much you can do about it. As we see in the case of our own worshipable Srila Prabhupada, who was obviously intensely Krishna conscious, but within the home, it seems he didn't have as much influence as his wife, who was not compatible in the sense she didn't share his central goal of life, which was to be intensely Krishna conscious, and his Srila Prabhupada's children didn't imbibe that. We have also the children of Advaita Acharya. Some became Vaishnavas, some didn't. Some became anti-Vaishnava. So it's the duty to seriously try to bring up the children in Krishna consciousness. And that is the main duty and of parents in Krishna consciousness, differentiated from even Vedic marriage. What Vedic marriage, what does that mean nowadays? There are still a few Vedic brahmanas here and there, but mostly in India people are very materialistic, in some ways more materialistic than in the West. They're just not so degraded, but they're very interested in money, prestige, and especially among the middle class, it's very prominent. Maybe in the West they're not so overtly concerned with these things, because you can get sense gratification of all levels, because there is no culture, you can just get sense gratification. It doesn't matter whether you're married or not married or whatever. If you have money, you do whatever you like. That's all. And you don't need much money to buy a few drugs. And it's a completely horrible society. Another point I thought... Can you all hear me okay? I can't hear any background sound. Okay. Another point I thought is that traditionally we wouldn't be discussing these things at all. There wouldn't be any need to so much, because culture means you grow up in it, just like a fish doesn't think about water. He just lives in it, that's all. So in the same way, if you grow up in a culture where everyone's doing what they're supposed to do, and there's really no question of doing anything else, then you automatically do that. You don't have the choice of doing anything else. And of course, in Vedic culture, the values of Vedic culture are inculcated by practice and precept. Practice means you see your father acting in such a way, and you see all the other men in the village acting in a similar kind of way, and then the boys growing up know that this is how men act. And they imbibe that automatically. They don't have any other understanding of what it means to be a man. A man means you're a husband and a father. And another thing is by precept also, because in Vedic culture traditionally there's lots of Shastric discourse. Reciting Mahabharata, Ramayana, having dramas. The grandmothers will tell stories, even they may be not fully religious stories, just like in Mahabharata we have so many not very religious, not directly devotional. Nala and Damayanti is a famous story which very much presents the faithfulness and chastity of a wife, but it's not directly connected to Paramartha. It's very much of this world. But people would grow up hearing this, and especially Ramayana. It really inculcates dharma. The fact that Rama is dharma vigraha. Ramo dharma vigraha. He's the very form of dharma. And he's Maryada Purushottam. The importance of dharma is very much stressed by Ramayana, and then how to act in certain circumstances Again and again, we find in Ramayana and Mahabharata that decisions are made, that difficult decisions arise in life, and it's always settled, it's always considered in terms of dharma that we see with Arjuna. That's how the Bhagavad Gita came to be spoken, because he's adharma bibhavat Krishna. This act, what I'm about to do is going to be adharma, and the natural conclusion is that therefore I shouldn't do it. So that's very much inculcated by dramas, by speaking, formal speaking. There may be pandits in the village who speak on Shastra and explain it to other people. There may be traveling speakers, and then again in the home, the grandmothers, they speak the stories, and especially Sita is very much a role model. And Srila Prabhupada also stressed very much on the chastity of Gandhari, how she approached her marriage. She's a young princess. She's thinking, I'm going to be married to a great king, but she heard she's going to be married to Dhritarashtra, who's blind. He was a great king, but he was blind, so then she became blind. So all these kind. Srila Prabhupada often spoke on this, didn't he, on this topic of female chastity. He spoke of the woman who he saw in Ahmedabad, I think it was, whose husband was blind and lame, and she would dress him and bathe him very nicely every day and take him out for begging. And she was young and pretty, but she served him like that. And Srila Prabhupada quoted when he was speaking with his friend once in a room somewhere in Calcutta, then the cleaning woman came for cleaning the room, which means she's from Bangi caste, which is really low, but she was so chaste she wouldn't come in the room. And himself and his friend had to leave the room so she could come inside the room. Many times Srila Prabhupada spoke about this. There's the one he was going on the train and a young girl, about 14, was a village girl, was going for marriage. And she had her face covered with the veil. And there was a young modern girl, they're all dead by now, but at the time, there was a young modern girl who was taunting her, what are you covering your face for? What's all this? And the other girl didn't say anything. At one point, she just got up and slapped the other girl in the face. And everyone else in the carriage said, yes, she's done the right thing. So Srila Prabhupada gave many examples like this to show it. These are not even examples from Krishna consciousness. They're just examples of how people live in a civilized society. Now that consciousness is under tremendous attack, just like we heard from Encyclopedia Britannica. Analytically, they got a lot of it right, but the poison is there also. That the fact that religion has always been seen as a sacred function, traditionally in society. Otherwise, there's no need. What do you need a marriage for? And that's what people say often now. Why do you need to get married? What's the point? It's just a piece of paper. There was no paper previously. It's just a piece. And legally, you don't require, even legally, you don't require to marry, because if a man lives with a wife for a certain period of time in most countries, then common law marriage, that's there in British jurisprudence. I don't know if it's in American. That means if you live together and have children, if you live as husband and wife, then you're treated in law as husband and wife. That means if they're children, then the children can take the property and all this kind of thing. But marriage was required, and it was a big function, very big function. In India, they've reduced it to a few hours now, and the main thing is the bharat with everyone drunk and dancing, vulgar music. But it used to go on for several days, especially in the higher caste, and it's a very big thing. It's a sanskar. Sanskar means, well, sanskar means a Vedic ritual which is performed at various stages in life, and they're all concerned with marriage. Taking sannyas is not a sanskar. Antyeshti, that's the death ritual. Otherwise, we have it begins with vivaha sanskara, then there's garbhadhana sanskara, and then there's the simantonayana, I can't remember all of them, simantonayanam samskara, and the then at the birth, then there's the namakaran, and it's all connected with marriage. And then maturation of the girl, they have a festival also, because that means she's ready for having children. It's all connected with marriage, and it's all connected with religion. And it all helps to focus the society on the importance of marriage. Having a very big marriage, a very big ceremony, that the sanskara creates an impression on the mind of this is something very important. It's not something that can be given up just like that. So there are many, many points. Yeah, the main point in Krishna conscious marriage is Krishnarthe Akhila Cheshta. Everything should be done for the satisfaction of Krishna. Whereas in secular marriage, why do you do it? You don't really know. You just drift into it. Most people drift through their lives. They don't really know why they're doing what they're doing. And even if you ask people, what is the purpose of your life, they often have to stop and think about it. They think it's a strange question that no one asks. You just drift into it. Quoted Bhaktivinoda Thakur, was it Dharma Smariya Grihiniya Kor? How does that go? You quoted that Nartha Gauranga. I remembering Dharma, I accepted a wife, the hand of a wife. But even that's often done automatically, that people, they follow Dharma. Why do you follow Dharma? Well, that's just what you do. So there is a difference between Vaishnava and Vedic marriage even, because people, exactly why you follow, not very clear about that. Just everyone does it and we do it. People tend to follow the conventions of the society they're born into. Just like if you ask most people, why are you a Christian? And they'll say, well, the Bible, this, that. And why are you a Muslim? And they'll say, Quran, and this, and that. But the actual reason is because they're born into it. They didn't think about it. Now what we have is so many people all over the world taking to Krishna consciousness. Either they're married previously or they get married after taking to Krishna consciousness. Are we doing enough to make it clear to those who are in Krishna consciousness, married, how to live their lives centered on Krishna? Are we doing that? You don't think so, Gopalacharya? It seems to be a lot of confusion trying to be somewhat Krishna conscious while working within the template of having marriage with a secular cultural understanding. What do you think? Any thoughts about that?
Guru Maharaj, as you said, that most people just drift into it in the secular world. Within ISKCON as well, I think, first of all, we're not doing enough. And as you've described, that is one of the purposes of these talks. We barely have, or some places we do have training for the brahmacharis and the temple residents, but for those who are living outside, no. Also, what we've noticed is that the householders, their exposure to Krishna consciousness is mostly limited to temple, what they see happening in a temple, which is great. But they do not get exposure to others who are living as within Grihastha Ashram or as role models. As in most people in congregation nowadays, they're busy 6 days a week. The seventh day, they can take out the time to go to the temple. They go to the temple, they get together. But on the other hand, if there were occasions where they were interacting, going to the household of being able to observe how those who've lived their life according to the tenets of Krishna conscious marriage were living, conducting, it would make a huge difference. We have a lot of conversation on scriptures, which is necessary for our spiritual elevation. But the topic about dharma, especially with respect to marriage, is not much talked about. One is because those who are speaking are mostly renunciants or temple residents. And even the householders, when they have to speak, a lot of times they try to emulate or talk about the same topics that the renunciants are talking. Times they're feeling a bit, I would say, they still feel, this is something not to be talked about. Or they feel that these are topics of Maya. Those who've gone through the temple, now it has changed, but at least till about 15, 20 years ago, if one moved out of the temple and get married, it wasn't seen very positively. It left negative impressions. In general. Gurmaj, one point that did cross my mind when you were speaking was with respect to, if we had to contrast the Vedic marriage and secular marriage, which was one of the things you wanted us to reflect on today, sometimes the success of a formula is seen by the results it produces, right? And I was thinking that if actually we see Vedic marriage or Vaishnava marriage, they inspired, they created role models, and they created a situation where devotees or people would properly get married. They would accept that institution of marriage. Now, in contrast, I like to say that even though there are high-flaunting definitions, one of which I read this at the beginning of this conversation, The irony is people don't even know this definition, the so-called civilized definition. And one can postulate just by observation that because religion is not part of it, this definition, there is a gradual decline. And what we notice, this so-called secular institution of marriage,
Hrishikesh,
one can see that actually has led to the destruction of marriage as an institution. So, if you contrast these two institutions, Vedic marriage and secular marriage is in a free fall. It leads to the destruction of the very thing that it is. The institution of marriage itself is getting destroyed with the number of divorces, people's unwillingness to get married. So, if within our society in general, or let's say specifically in ISKCON, if there was an effort to talk about duty within marriage, the foundation of marriage, how one must conduct, I think it would do great benefit, because it is not a unknown fact that there are several children within our society of ISKCON also who are at the receiving end. When Guru Maharaj, you asked at the beginning, if roles are not clear, if how we perform our duty is not clear, who suffers the most? One could argue it is the children. And in the theories that are discussed to sustain something from being a new religious movement to become a prominent religion, it is observed that if the next generations, mostly the children, don't get grounded in Krishna consciousness or the philosophy, then it's a story of 50 people in and 59 people out of the movement. So one cannot underscore more or deny that so much more needs to be done. Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj.
Would others like to add more to that?
Yes, Guru Maharaj. Natak Ranga Prabhu, you want to
say? Natak Ranga?
Yes, Guru Maharaj. Guru Maharaj, one point is very important as to understand is that now in our ISKCON society, those who cannot remain as brahmachari, they fall down to grihastha ashram. They think it like this. But in our varnashram-based society, if we implement it like that, that good brahmacharis can become good grihasthas. So those who are good brahmachari candidates also, they take up grihastha ashram as a dharma and then show how to become a good grihastha and live the life based on dharma, then it will be a good role models in the ISKCON society. So I think we should also work on those principles that we encourage good persons, good brahmacharis to take up dharma based vivaha samskara, and then they show it to the whole world. So that may be one thing to practically implement the society based on.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll get into discussing that in more detail in an upcoming talk. Who else is going to speak? Nitya Gaura Prabhu?
Yes, Guru Maharaj. I feel that Tapan Mishra Prabhu and particularly him, he hit the nail on the head, because the amount of time that the grihasthas have to even learn these things is very little. They go on Sunday usually as the only, program, unless they are fortunate like ourselves. We can go more than once a week. We live right next to the temple, but then at a Sunday feast, they're not going to hear about detailed topics like how grihasthas should live, how brahmacharya should live. They're going to hear, the Sunday feast lecture, which is excellent, but unless they're going to Bhagavatam classes or something, it seems like unless they associate closely with a rural community or something, they're not going to even learn these finer points in life, like how different people should live in different orders of life. So that seems to be the only practical solution is living in a community like that. I don't know how else people will learn those things.
Every marriage is a new experiment. Everyone has to work it out themselves each time. You can listen to a few talks on YouTube. That's all you get. That's why we have to set up communities, as you said. That'll be very helpful for grihastha devotees. Gopala Acharya Prabhu, please speak.
One more thing that I wanted to add to the discussion, that concept of duty, this is also one which is a we could say, bitter pillow to swallow for many devotees who join in Western countries, because oftentimes Krishna consciousness is perceived as a way out of all duties. We give up everything, and I discussed this with some of the devotees. Women especially, they feel like that when they come to Krishna consciousness, it is a very liberating experience for them, that we can do everything. We can go on the altar, we can do all those wonderful services. We are all spirit souls. We are not women, we are not the body, and so on and so on. And when it comes to discussing things like duties and, female role, male role within the society, the whole concept of an ashram, then it becomes very difficult. They just don't want to really embrace any of these kind of discussions. So this is where we start stumbling in the, or struggling with, in the concept of even married life, because that ethos of equality, which modern society also fosters so much, it is very strong, it's very alive. And so this is also part of a challenge that we need to somehow or other address, in the sense that devotees need to be very strongly and very accurately and also maturely educated about. We need to understand what is Krishna consciousness, how does it translate into our everyday life, because we do get married and we have all those situations that we end up in, which are in a way material. There are material considerations which have to be addressed, but they are oftentimes not. It's just we're all spirit souls and we don't want to hear about these things. So that's a lot of difficulty, at least in the Western Hemisphere, that we need to address somehow or other. But there is, it seems to be very off-putting subject matter to most. They don't want to even start those discussions. They immediately go into, we are spirit souls, we don't need those things, we don't need to discuss such matters. It is all material. Varnashram is material. So, of course, we have addressed this many times, but there are not many who do address that. And as far as training programs, we don't see any such training programs in ISKCON really. We have Guru Disciple course, we have Bhakti Shastri courses, but how to live, how to enter Grihastha Ashram, we say usually that good Brahmachari will make good Grihastha, but I would maybe not entirely agree with it. I mean, in certain way, yes, but we still require very detailed training for both men and women.
I would say that good Brahmachari makes a good Grihastha is especially true in a functional Varnashram society, where it's clear what a Brahmachari is and what is clear what a Grihastha is.
Yes. But within the modern context of what ISKCON is and where there is no Varnashram as such, functional Varnashram, then we would require so much detailed training to be provided to the prospective Grihasthas.
That's why I often say that Srila Prabhupada said that 50% of his work is to be done, that's establishing Varnashram. That's huge, because what Srila Prabhupada did was unprecedented, unimaginable, of bringing Krishna consciousness to the Western world. And it seems that in general, within our ISKCON society, devotees don't even want to think about Varnashram, because it's such a challenge. Maybe just like Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers, they didn't even want to think about going to the West and preaching Krishna consciousness because it was just so unimaginable and impossible. And it just didn't seem like it was even worth thinking about it. So that's a great challenge to establish that. But unless and until we establish working varnashrams of society, then we're going to continue with the same terrible problems that we have. That we have the highest philosophy, but when it comes to family life or even things like not having child abuse, as a society, ISKCON's not doing well. And we hear a devotee of age 40, 50, it's very common, and they say, well, my former wife or my former husband, and as if it's the most normal thing in the world, which it is within our society. But it just means that we're not setting up stable society. So it's very, very, very great challenges ahead. At least we should start to discuss it, as we're doing here, and then there can be some hope of something coming out of it. Just like with our farm communities, pilot varnashram communities, we talked about it a lot. And there's the thinking, feeling, willing. We gradually move toward it. And we're still moving toward it. There's so much to be done. It is experimental. Srila Prabhupada's going to the West was experimental. He didn't know what he was going to end up with. He thought he was going to preach to the intellectual class, and he ended up with these, mostly with wild hippies. And he tried out different things. Wanted them to chant 64 rounds, couldn't do it. 32 rounds, couldn't do it. He got them married on the basis of Krishna consciousness, expecting that they would just stay together on the basis of that. Most of them didn't. It is social experimentation. But it has to be done. Otherwise, we're trying to run Krishna consciousness on the template of less than animalistic society. And it's not going to work. We have a different outlook on the whole purpose of life. Ethics and economics, very much mixed, as Karl Marx pointed out. So Varnashram is very much concerned with the division of labor. It's an economic question, socio-economic question. Without having Varnashram society, it's very difficult to implant the values of paro-dharma, the highest dharma. So, many, many things to discuss. I've talked about these things in many, many lectures in a theoretical way, and it's up to you, the Grihasthas of ISKCON, to reify that. That means to bring a concept into actuality, to actualize it. Mataji Vaishnavi, please say what you want to say.
So as not to upset so many of the practicing devotees who are attempting to train in this capacity, there is the organization of the Grihastha Vision Team. And I'm not sure if it's inappropriate to mention that, because from what I've read from one of the handbooks that they've
published... Could you just tell us what the Grihastha Vision Team is? Here in India, we don't hear anything about it, for better or for worse. Maybe it's...
I'm not extremely familiar. Hopefully, maybe if there's another devotee that can speak more about it. But at least in the United States, there is this organization of the Grihastha Vision Team. And so they have a website. They have at least one book that I'm familiar with that I was handed after I was married. And the function or the purpose of the organization is to train and counsel and to help devotees in their Grihastha ashram. And so I wanted to mention that because there has been an attempt in this regard, but what I see as one of the flaws of the foundation of this Grihastha Vision Team is that there's a lot of emphasis on modern psychology and using a modern psychological approach to help counsel and guide practicing devotees in their married life. Not to say that they don't bring up scriptural examples and guidance, but because they do put importance on licensed, trained counselors within the, you know, academic arena to actually help practicing devotees, as opposed to not that these devotees aren't experienced householders, but there's just a lot of emphasis on this modern psychological approach to solving the conflicts that arise. And I see that's a main reason why there's still so much a need for training and guidance. And I wanted to bring up one other point is that Gurmaraj, you've basically been speaking on this, is that there hasn't been an imbibing of the culture. And so the communities that we've lived in, at least one of them where there were devotees there, there's still so much mixing of men and women, even amongst practicing devotees that have been practicing for decades. There's still so much of a familiarity between men and women. And in that same community, it was also the case that there were many couples that had actually, you know, one was previously married to the other, but now that one husband is married to someone else and his former wife is married to someone else. And that's actually kind of common in other devotee communities as well, that you see that devotees, they were once married, but now they're married to other devotees. And it's, you know, you can understand that it's because of this problem of mixing between men and women and this lack of seriousness about avoiding that, and how much Srila Prabhupada emphasized that the mixing between the sexes was such a big problem. So I just wanted to add that. If you want to say.
Oh, I just feel like in America, there's practically what's the word?
Tradition.
It's like anti-tradition. Yeah.
Among the devotees.
You may make enemies if you speak about that. You do make enemies if you speak about the traditional roles and the tradition.
Don't
with
I know
other
it.
American devotees? Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, the emphasis is on psychology rather than dharma and duties. In Croatia, somewhere, I was put up in someone's apartment. I think they didn't have a temple. He was a psychology student, the owner of the apartment, who had gone off to England or something. So I saw one of his books. I just opened his college psychology book, and it showed some theoretical or actual discussions between the psychotherapist and patients. So one woman comes in and she says that I'm having so many problems in my marriage. And she goes to the psychologist, right? But I love my husband and I don't want to divorce. And at the end of the session, he's convinced her to divorce. So actually, you should be more realistic. You have to have a whole life ahead of you. Why be in a relationship if you're not happy, blah, 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 and okay, divorce. That's a slur. That's what you get for going to a psychologist. That's something we can discuss in our next session. We're supposed to be discussing compatibility. One of the things is, what do you do if you're stuck in an incompatible relationship? we could discuss that in the next session. Let's finish now. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you so much for undertaking the austerity of married life. It's also, we tend to think of the brahmachari, vanaprastha, and sannyasi as austere life. But from my perspective, it seems the married life is in many ways more austere. Physical comfort might be there more, but there's a lot more real world responsibility. And it is a great austerity to look after children. It's a pleasure also for the householders, but that's one reason why brahmacharis, they avoid marriage, because they don't want to accept the responsibility. They say, it's too much headache. So you're accepting that. All right, these are very basic talks and little churning, and let's maybe some poison will come out, as in the churning of the milk ocean. So many things came out, but ultimately nectar comes out. So that's what you get in the material world, right? That, well, that's rajoguna. What is that? Yatadagre vishamina eva parinami mrithopamam. In the beginning, it's like poison, and in the end, it is bliss, amrita. That's happiness in the mode of, yeah, it's run the other way, in the mode of passion. How does that begin, that verse? In the beginning, it seems like nectar. I don't remember now. I should remember, but I didn't. We have to have brahmacharis trained up who can remember their verses. Hare Krishna, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Vancha kalpa turubhyascha kripa sindubhya evacha patita nam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Dante nidhaya churnakang padayone patya kritva chaka kushatameta da hambravimi heis sadhava sakala eva vihaya durat gauranga chandra charne kurutanu ragaha parivadatu jano yata tata va nanumokarona vayang vicharayamaha hari rasa madira madati mata Bhuvi Vilutama Nartama Nirvisham. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.